the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Well, it's a fact of the life and human experience that if you don't use it, you will lose it. And that can certainly be said with respect to local restaurants as well. Such an important part of our lives. And yet, clearly, many of us don't actually take up the opportunity of actually appreciating them and so on. However, maybe that's changing. In 2022, there were over 150,000 restaurants in the UK, which was an increase of 8% on 2019. So good news there. And why are restaurants such an important part of our community, with two-thirds of people actually believing that local places to eat are important in building a sense of community? Well, we've got two fabulous folk to actually talk about with respect to this report. First of all, the Senior Vice President of International Growth at Open Table. That's Robin Chiang. How are you, Robin?
Nice to meet you.
Excellent. Good to connect with your good self. And we've also got a practitioner with respect to the restaurant business itself. Of course, that's Fraser from Angels with Bagpipes. How are you, Fraser?
I'm good, thanks, Alex. How are you?
Excellent. And I'm presuming, given the title Angels with Bagpipes, you're not based in the joys of Sassanac country, are you?
No. We're on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh.
Exactly. Just want to make that quite clear. No, of course, we're all one United Kingdom, and that's the important thing about this. So it's great to hear with respect to that. Robin, let's turn to you first. I mean, were you surprised by this particular area? Because, I mean, there have been a number of challenging years in the industry. And as I said at the start, you know, this tendency that we actually have to say, OK, well, we can't go out to dine, it's too expensive, or all sorts of other excuses. You know, maybe are we turning the corner?
Well, we definitely weren't surprised. You know, at Open Table, we're obsessed with restaurants and are in awe of all the things that great restaurateurs do. Like, basically, you know, what Fraser does at Angels with Bagpipes, it's fantastic that they're going day in, day out. And for us, restaurants have bounced back strongly with the support of the dining public since the pandemic. But the longer-term stuff, the ability to build a sense of community and improving personal well-being, that we always knew, because we're in and out of restaurants every day at Open Table. So for me, that is, you know, what came through in the report, and we really wanted to showcase that here.
Fraser, I'm looking at the data here from opentable.co.uk, and I'm seeing that Edinburgh is very much up there as a place where there are the most explorative diners. Effectively, Edinburgh residents are prepared to travel the longest to reach their favourite restaurants, travelling up to 40 minutes to get to Edinburgh. I mean, is that because, well, of course, when you do that, you expect to have some angels with bagpipes performing for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible stat, actually, but it's not one I'm really surprised by. You know, I live in East Lothian, and, you know, we need to travel 40 minutes to get to Edinburgh. You know, I myself have travelled to London just to eat in a restaurant because of what they offer and the different experiences that you get.
Well, London has, interestingly, the most diverse dining scene, which I suppose you might say, yeah, that's okay. I mean, I would have thought Edinburgh should be coming a close second to that. Or is it a case of, no, we prefer to actually keep our haggis pure?
No, I don't think so. I think there's so many different cuisines in Edinburgh now that you know, you don't have to have your traditional Scottish. We're on the Royal Mile, obviously, so there's an aspect of that has to be in the menu. But there's a very diverse range of restaurants in Edinburgh now.
Close by to Lincoln, of course, Sheffield, well, not too far away, the most affordable dining city, Robin. You averaged just under £25. Well, actually, you're fair enough, £24.56. I mean, a bargain for Sheffield residents. Do you think that's going to be rolled out across the country?
Look, I think there's, you know, UK has been fantastic. So I moved here in 2019. I'm originally Australian. There's a whole range of different cuisines and price points all across the UK. And as Fraser said, you know, just within the Royal Mile, there's a whole range of price points and cuisines just there. And that for us is what we want to celebrate. And you can see, we highlighted four of them in the Open Table report. So if those are interested, it's called the Open Table Restaurant Impact Report. And that's diversity that we see across the UK. But like, you know, I think that the dining scene everywhere is really interesting, up and down, sort of from fine dining all the way to your local joints.
Yeah, I was quite intrigued to see that the most regular diners are actually found in the city of Liverpool. 17% of Liverpudlians dining twice or more in 1 week. I mean, I'm curious. I don't know. For some reason, I thought it might have been Newcastle or Manchester, but there we are. Just goes to show my predictions. Serious note, Robin. I mean, actually, dining out can actually help our well-being, our personal well-being, and so on. And interesting enough, a third of British folks surveyed agreed that local restaurants, pubs, and cafes or add value to their well-being. Sometimes we tend to forget that. I mean, it is important that the sense of going out, not just for the theatre and so on, but going to the restaurant afterwards or before, is significant.
Yeah, and it's the chance to gather, whether that's with your loved one, your family, friends, and even with colleagues, and sometimes with strangers. That's builds a sense of community and sense of personal well-being. And I think 15% of people across the UK, when they walk into their local hospitality venue, they expect it to be called or frequently called by their first name. And for me, I travel a lot internationally. When I come home back to London, I walked into my local restaurant and they greet me with, "Oh, welcome back, Robin." And that for me has a real sense of coming home. So I totally understand that improving personal well-being, building sense of community and all of that we've highlighted in the report. And it's from like great restaurateurs, like once again, like Fraser, that really makes like the whole experience when I'm dining out, fantastic. It's the great food, but also the great hospitality.
Fraser, is this something that connects with yourself in Edinburgh? Do you always make sure that you recognise your customers, even the ones who you might have found quite challenging? Because let's face it, sometimes customers can be a tiny bit challenging when they insist on various aspects that aren't on the menu.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that we really focus on here. We have maybe cocktails that are off the menu now, and people like them and they'll ask for them. And it's something that we want to be personal with, as a business, and make sure that people that have come before will get the same experience the next time. And we really try and focus on the people and, certainly the returning customers. The difficult ones, yeah, I mean, it's our job and the front house guys' job to make them feel at ease as well, and make sure that we're doing everything that we can. And using open tables is a great way of creating notes and different things like that, so that we can recognize that and we know what our customers are needing and what they're wanting, even if there's a new member of staff on or something like that.
Robin, returning back to yourself, as you mentioned, you're from Australia, known, of course, for its sense of hospitality and so on. In Britain, do we compare favourably with Australia, or is it a case of, I don't know, we've got a long, long way to go in Britain before we start getting the levels of friendliness that you get in Sydney or indeed Melbourne?
I travel a lot in the US as well. And I think for the restaurant industry, one thing that everyone has in common is the hospitality. I think what you remember about a restaurant, you do sometimes remember the food, but more importantly, you remember how you feel. And that's the whole experience. And, what we highlight a restaurant that's not too far from where I live in Angel, called Jam Delish. The proprietor there is called Jordan Johnson, and that's like a fantastic restaurant, Caribbean vegan, not the typical type of my everyday place, but like it's incredible hospitality, incredible food, and it's a mix of locals and first timers in there. So I think restaurant industry across all of OpenTable's 55,000 restaurants, it's all about hospitality and making people feel great, and having great food as well.
As we said at the start of the piece, make sure that you actually do use those facilities and continue to actually support the area. Let's turn finally back to Fraser. Fraser, people actually want to locate you on the Royal Mile. They're thinking of booking ahead. Clearly, your media profile is being ramped up on this sort of basis. How many months ahead do they need to book?
We're actually fairly lucky that you could get in mostly Saturdays a couple of weeks in advance, but during the week we've got plenty of seats, so we managed to keep some tables spare anyway, just in case of the off chance of some regulars or some people out of town that are looking for something a wee bit different.
Excellent. And do you have a website you'd like to promote as well for Angels with Bagpipes?
Yeah, so that's www.angelswithbagpipes.co.uk.
Fantastic. And back to yourself, Robin, in terms of people wanting to find out more details about Open Table and the report and such like, where would you suggest they should go?
Just search for Open Table Restaurant Impact Report. That should pop up in your search.
Fantastic. Robin Chang, SVP of International Growth at Open Table. And of course, Fraser, I won't say happy eating, but I'll say happy restaurant experiencing, gentlemen. Keep on keeping on.
Thanks for having us.
Nutrition, absolutely vital. Let's face it, if you have sugared water and you use it to fuel your car, it's not going to work, especially if it's electric. But in terms of the whole notion of food and functional foods, what can they do? Well, they can help increase energy, they can boost our mood, they can improve memory. They are fantastic functional foods. And we've got two fabulous folk to actually share with us their own involvement with respect to this. First of all, nutritionist extraordinaire, it's Dana Chapman. How are you, Dana?
I'm very good, thank you.
Got to say, is it Dana or Dana? I should have asked you this before we started, but which do
Okay.
you prefer?
Dana.
Dana. Okay, Dana. And we've got the equally fabulous Robin Longdon, founder of Rolla Granola, which of course is a family-run granola business with a focus on nutrition. How are you, Robin?
I'm very well, Alex. Lovely to meet you.
Excellent. Dana, share with us the whole aspect of why these functional foods can be so important, because one of our fine level six students at the University of Lincoln is a committed vegetarian. He says, yes, I like my granola, says Megan.
Functional foods help provide more benefit to the body than simply the nutrients that they contain. So they help balance blood sugar levels, they help support the gut and the gut microbiome, and in that way, they help promote things like more energy, more stable energy, and those cognitive and brain health benefits as well.
And certainly the benefits of that, as you mentioned, brain and heart function and so on, can be so important. And maybe we just don't realize just how much we're kind of not improving or getting our bodies to function at an optimal level simply because of the fuel we're taking.
Very true.
Robin, let's talk about granola and in particular Rolla granola from that line. Is this something you've always known? Was there a moment in your life where you thought, this is it, I've finally been converted, this is the whole essence of the whole thing? Or is it just a case of, well, functional foods have always been part of my life?
No, far from it. I guess I've always been a healthy eater. I've always been one of those people that, genuinely would go and enjoy a salad. It might sound strange, but I always have done. But it's not necessarily been a family trait. So, as the cook in the house, you adapt to everyone else. But to be honest, we had a holiday in the States one time, had some great granola, and my other half, who is not a healthy eater at all, despite my best efforts over many years, she actually tolerated me going into this lovely little eatery. And we had some granola, and Sue sat there and said, actually, I quite like this. Should we buy a bag of it? And all of a sudden, you kind of think, well, if Sue would eat it, maybe there's something in it. And then when we got home, I researched endlessly into nuts and seeds and the benefits of nuts and seeds and what cinnamon can do for blood health and what sugars can do. And so I put a lot of work into it and came away convinced that not only was there an opportunity to make a good granola, but actually, the products that were on the market really weren't providing the sort of benefits in terms of energy and mood that they could do if they contained those ingredients. And so, crazily enough, I went out and said, at the time everyone is trying to sell cheap product, I'm going to sit on a market stall in freezing cold and try and sell granola to people. And lo and behold, people kept coming back. And all of a sudden, we had a business. And to be honest, it's just taken off from there.
You could almost use it as a strap line, really. If Sue likes it, maybe there's something in it. I'm just thinking away from that, but which could maybe personalize the whole thing even more. Were you surprised by the research, obviously by your company, Rolla Granola, that many of us have a desire to consume more foods that actually serve a specific function and, again, help us to improve various aspects of our well-being and health?
Yeah, I think that the scale of it was quite significant for me. So I guess, you know, we've always felt that there are people out there who want slightly better food, but we've always thought of it as kind of, let's say, 10 or 12% of the market. But then for the size of the upswell of opinion in there, and most importantly, people looking for something as part of their diet in their food, it's not, I want a supplement, it's not, I want to eat this instead of that. It's they wanted it to be part of their diet. And I guess that speaks to the pressures that everyone's under and the fact that if it's not part of your diet, you're probably going to struggle to include it because otherwise you already would have done. So the notion of providing those benefits to people and adapting, you know, what is a range of good products and then bringing in additional nootropic ingredients seemed, you know, a natural evolution for us, as long as we could make sure that the ingredients had integrity and weren't either esoteric or ultra-processed.
Dana, let's talk about some of the other functional foods that are available. Nuts, of course, known to benefit heart and brain function. Eggs to help with learning and memory. Dark chocolate to boost cognitive performance. And, of course, green tea for relaxation. As a nutritionist, is this something which you thought, well, why doesn't everybody know these kind of things?
Absolutely. But I think people are becoming more aware of what they're putting into their bodies and wanting to look and buy those ingredients that are going to support them on more levels than one.
And what about the nootropic foods that can help us improve our cognitive abilities? Much needed, obviously, for students of all ages, but perhaps more so if you're in the academic world and so on, you know, concentration and mental well-being. How can we actually seek out nootropic foods?
There are few that are coming onto the market at the moment. Of course, Rolla Granola does have a nootropics range as well. And like you said, is that benefit for the brain and not only cognitive health today, but it's helping support brain health into the future and as we age as well.
I mean, Robin, will Sue also go for nootropics? Is that a step too far?
Oh, no, she's on board with it. She actually likes the body and soul best. So it's, if you ever travel, you know, and you fill up your car, if you want something to eat, what are you going to have? It's crisps or sugary snacks. Actually, you know, you could have a bag of granola with you if you wanted to. It would do you no harm to just nibble on a bit of it as you go along, which is exactly what Sue does, because Sue delivers our zero waste and is front and center of our zero waste business. And she takes it out with her and will have a nibble on the day rather than indulging in all the other alternatives out there, which seem infinitely worse. And I have to say, Sue would not naturally eat fruit unless it was a nice apple. So we're providing her an alternative for that as well.
Dana, including at present, adaptogenic foods or adaptogenic herbs and foods that help to manage stress and indeed adaptogenic coffees. Is that just coffee without the caffeine or is that too simplistic?
No, a lot of the adaptogenic coffees do actually have caffeine in them, but they have the added ingredients of the adaptogenic herbs.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Robin, how can people find out more about Rolla Granola and indeed this particular research?
Well, we'd love them to come to our website and look at our range of products. This is quite a new area, so there is strong interest and strong growth in it. But those people who want to know about it, I'd really recommend just doing a little bit of research. If you plug nootropics or adaptogenic herbs into your Google search, you're going to find out, you know, some really good research in there, because not everyone's pitching something. Some people are, obviously, like us. But there is good information there which will help you look at those things which are most likely to help your lifestyle. We've got four products. Each of them's got a little stack of nootropic ingredients in there. So those may well be ones that suit your need. But also it may well be that there's something else out there that would be really good for you that's going to help your lifestyle, because we recognize everyone's different and we can't cover the whole market. We're not trying to do that. But we do really believe that there's a genuine benefit to lifestyle and general health from including these sorts of products in your life.
Dana, where can people find out more about your own work?
Thank you so much. I have my own website, which is dc-nutrition.co.uk, but I am also on Rolo Granola's website as their in-house nutritionist.
Fantastic. Nutritionist extraordinaire Dana Chapman, and indeed Robin Longdon, founder of Rolo Granola. Many thanks indeed, and may your nutrition continue to be beneficial in every sense of the word.
Thank you very much indeed, Alex.
Thank you, Alex.
So take my hand as we carry our pots home and let the what if spill out on streets ready to roam, taking center stage, ready to be heard, ready to make change. The final verse, an awesome construction created by a true genius when it comes to poetry. Of course, the guest on the program today for National Poetry Day, it's poet and spoken word artist Jaspreet Kaur. How are you, Jaspreet?
Hi, Alex. Really well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to get with you. So, by the way, is it Jaspreet or Jaspreet?
Jaspreet.
Jaspreet. Excellent. Okay. Yeah. This was produced, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because obviously it's awesome. You can obviously go to read it yourself. I just read the final verse from that point of view. But how did you come up with this notion of the people's poem?
Firstly, can I say you read the final verse beautifully, so thank you for that. So this amazing project, The People's Poem, was thought of by Sanofi UK, where we had the opportunity to call out to the general public to use poetry as a way to reflect on their health experiences. And I was brought on as the people's poet to read these amazing entries that came through. We had around 150 participants send in their poems where they were able to share their experiences on health, whether that was their experiences of chronic illness, whether it was those who were carers for their loved ones, whether it was those living with rare diseases and disabilities. And this was giving them the opportunity to use creative expression as a way to share their experiences and maybe think about the things that they might want to change or they may want to see done better, and really encouraging this sense of curiosity. And I had the honor to then read all the poems that came through and use that as inspiration to write the people's poem, which was an amazing experience.
Well, as you said, over 150 people penned and submitted their health-inspired poetry. I'm fascinated in terms, of course, Rudyard Kipling, 100 or so years ago, produced If, which was very much his notion. Did you have that in mind when you actually referred to what if, or was that a case of no, Rudyard did his thing, I'm doing mine?
So the project was inspired by a lot of the what if poems from the past, from a number of different poets, whether it was Kipling or whether that was Benjamin Savaya's poem, What If. There's been a number of poets over the years that have used this kind of theme as inspiration for their work. So we took a note of that to inspire this project and to encourage people to use that theme and to think about that theme when they were writing their own pieces.
You, of course, produced and gave the TED Talk, How Poetry Saved My Life. So again, there's a direct connection between that and, of course, this side of the tale. And I'm really fascinated by, I mean, some of the people who actually participated, Deborah from Nottingham, of course, who wrote All About Me, Exploring Living with a Disability. We had Heather from London, who wrote her poem Monster about the depression she experienced following a mini stroke. Is there something cathartic in actually getting your thoughts down in a form of poetry that enables you to effectively address some deeply personal issues?
Absolutely. I think that is the real power of poetry, and it can be the real power of creative expression. It allows you to let out a lot of those emotions, those feelings, those thoughts that you might be bottling up inside. And I've seen that firsthand, even for myself, that is how my journey as a poet and as a writer began. When I was around 13 years old, I was suffering from anxiety attacks. And at that point, I had no one to talk to and no access to mental health support. So I was using poetry as my form of therapy, as my way to let out all those things I was bottling in. So I saw firsthand in my own life over the years how it can support my well-being, and that is what I've been wanting to show others too. So that is a lot of what my work centers around, getting people to tap into poetry and creative expression as a way to support their well-being. And it's something that all of us can actually do. And we saw that firsthand with this project.
The people's poem can carry with it a weight of responsibility. Did you at any time feel as though it's too much for my shoulders to bear? The people's poem, why not just sort of one or two individuals' poems?
Yeah, it's definitely a heavy thing to hold. You're reading through and listening to people's really vulnerable and personal experiences, especially when we're talking about something as personal as health. So it was a big task, and I really wanted to do justice to their stories and to their experiences to the best that I could. But in a way, it was easy to write the poem because the ones that were sent through were so incredible. They were so moving. They were so inspiring. So when I put pen to paper, it was all flowing quite quickly. So that part of it was actually the easy part. The harder part was processing a lot of those difficult things that people might have been sharing.
If people wish to find out more about National Poetry Day, even if they're listening to this after the 5th of October has passed and they're thinking, oh, we haven't got a time machine, what can we do for National Poetry Day in 2024? Where would you point them?
There's lots of amazing ways to look into National Poetry Day and also this Sanofi UK People's Poem Project. You can head to their website and you can have a read of the poem and watch the performance. Or you can even head to my social media, have a look at Jaspreet Kaur online, and you'll hear lots about this project as well as lots of my other poetry too.
Fantastic. It's been great connecting with you yourself this morning or this evening or whenever you listen to it. It's all very confusing. Jaspreet Kaur, a poet extraordinaire. What's your next project, Jaspreet? What are you going to be heading off to? I mean, obviously, you've done this health-based thing. Are you looking for something completely different? I don't know. Maybe dealing with avoiding the use of palm oil in other countries and such like?
What am I working on next? That's a great question. Right now, actually, I'm entering the journey of new parenthood. I just gave birth to our little baby girl about 5 months ago. So I am taking on this new challenge and this new chapter of my life as a mum. So taking a little bit slower this year and spending lots of time with my little one. But in the background, I have been working on a poetry collection. It is putting together a lot of the poems that I've been working on over this last decade. So hopefully we'll see something happening with that very soon.
Fantastic. Jaspreet Kaur, a genuine delight. Can I do the good self? I can't even get the words out, Jaspreet. It's that kind of day, really. But many thanks indeed. And of course, happy National Poetry Day.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
When the war started, they protected me. Took better care of me than humans would have.
They're not people, Maya. It's just programming.
10 years ago today, the artificial intelligence created to protect us detonated a nuclear warhead in Los Angeles. This is a fight for our very existence.
Sergeant Taylor, we are this close to winning the war. But the AI are developing a super weapon. Retrieve it. Or they win.
Yeah, it's just a kid.
Are you going to heaven?
No. You gotta be a good person to go to heaven.
So, we're the same. We can't go to heaven because you're not good. And I'm not a person.
Do you have any idea what the thing is?
She looks like a little girl now, but she's growing. Whoever has that kid wins the war.
Side you want, huh?
What do you want, sweetie?
For robots to be free.
Oh, we don't have that in the fridge. How about ice cream?
Dreamer, 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 dreamer.
Okay, so we've given you some advice on Rola Granola in terms of food energy, and we've talked about obviously going to the restaurants and supporting restaurants around the country and enjoying that restaurant experience. We've even had a little touch of national poetry. So why not actually follow through with how the basically a Rugby World Cup is progressing. Richard Fitzwilliams, I know that you have probably been devastated on behalf of Princess Anne that her nation, of course, Scotland, were duly trounced in the Rugby World Cup by indeed the wondrous Irish, who produced a fantastic performance, specifically Johnny Sexton going beyond the call of duty. And I know that will be a key sort of aspect, because it's certainly very popular in Australia, isn't it, given Australia's progression or lack of progression in the Rugby World Cup. Isn't that right, Natasha? Speechless, you see. Totally speechless. That's the whole thing. You see, Richard, say no more. You know, that's the whole sort of aspect about the whole thing. But it's been a sporting week, obviously, for Royal Watchers, because doubtless you will have identified clearly the importance and significance of the scoreline in the European Conference League that was present, and I mean, I don't need to tell you who the winning scorer was, because
why? No, good heavens! I mean, why would you bother?
You mean you wouldn't recognise this individual, this fabulous Aston Villa player who basically gave such joy to the Prince of Wales when he was actually seeing Aston Villa defeat the might of Zrinjski Lodstar, I think. Excuse the pronunciation. My Serbian is not up to standard on this particular area. But they won 1-0. So, you know, again, you could indeed, if you're following the sport, not only see the joys of the Rugby World Cup and Princess Anne, but you could even see the true wonderment of the European Games as well. I'm shocked, Richard. You mean to say you weren't covering these events?
Well, I have various other things to cover, Alex.
How can you possibly engage in fair play if you can't actually talk about the wonderment of Prince William watching Aston Villa get a 1-0 win in Europe with a very last-minute goal from John McGinn? I mean, surely
what I was talking about the last time with Prince William, of course, as president of the FA, and the fact that he didn't attend the Women's World Cup.
Yes, but he attended Aston Villa because he's an Aston Villa supporter.
However, regarding fair play, you rambled on, Alex, for at least 5 minutes, I think, or three or four anyway.
At least I didn't drop as many F-bombs as you get in 2 minutes of fair play. But anyway, over to you.
Yes, fair play is certainly a movie that is scripted with plenty of expletives. It's funny enough, I was looking forward very, very much to this movie, because sometimes when you put humanity under the microscope and you're looking at movies like Margin Call, which Jeremy Adler, absolutely superb, or The Big Short, which I think is something of a classic, it is certainly excellent. And I mean,
it's certainly better than Dumb Money, let's face it.
No, but I mean, Dumb Money, I thought it was better than you did. I mean, I didn't think that it was a brilliant film, but I did think that it was a sort of David versus Goliath theme that was explored quite well. I enjoyed it, and I certainly would recommend it. Fair Play is a movie that, well, if you're involved in hedge funds, there's a couple at the heart of this movie. Phoebe Dynevor, who was in Bridgerton, she plays Emily, and Emily is in fact in a secret relationship with Luke. Both are analysts, both work for this hedge fund, and both of them are in, this is the center of the entire movie. Working in this environment turns humans into some form of animal. They are absolutely grotesque, the way the whole working environment, the competition, the brutality, not to mention the sexism, which is so overt, and the way this is handled. It's quite interesting to begin with, because Emily believes that she's picked up some gossip that that her partner, as I say, secret partner Luke, is in fact going to get promoted to portfolio manager. However, you know, saying that, I have to say, most improbable. Eddie Marsan plays Campbell, and Campbell's the boss, and Campbell calls her out at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, in fact, it's going to be her. Now, this does not improve relations between them, far from it. In fact, he becomes frustrated, and it shows both in his sexual performance and in the way he tries to pick up from
books. You see, that was the first problem, you see. I mean, there are two major issues I have with this movie. Actually, strike that, three. One of which is you've got little blue pills now that could have sorted out that sort of action in terms of the incident. And also, how could it possibly be, if you got a situation whereby these people are cohabiting, that really wasn't known? So when she actually calls out at the end of the movie and Clive attempts to distance herself from the whole thing, surely that was just a complete destruction of the whole sort of toxic masculinity aspect we saw there.
Well, I mean, so far as the caller, she pretends that he's in fact been a stalker and so forth. But frankly, by then, and that's in the last part of the movie, by then I felt the plot and reality had gone in separate ways. Because firstly, it's her parents who hear and his don't of the engagement. They put a party, or at least they have in one of the scenes which frankly doesn't make a great deal of sense. Both sets of parents celebrate, and in point of fact, by then, the relationships between Emily and Luke are very, very rocky indeed, especially...
Oh, but they've become irrevocably separated from that.
No, we mustn't use words like irrevocably, because that could be a spoiler, Alex. I wouldn't wish to tick you off on that. Here is the problem with this movie. They're also an absolutely revolting story, which epitomizes the most gruesome sexism in which is so common with this sort of capitalist enterprise. It's identified with masculinity, and there's no question as well that there's a surprise for those who have been hooked by the 2 hours of this movie and find the last half hour more believable than me. I don't blame Phoebe Dynevor, who does her best, I think, in a role that, you know, she seems very adequately coping for. But Aidan Ehrenreich, yes, he's okay. The problem with this movie is it starts ticking too many boxes. So this is evil sexism. This is a sign of masculinity, and we see what his versus her.
It starts with blood. It ends with blood.
And I don't know. We don't want to give up. Give out anything.
That's not a spoiler. I'm just saying it starts with blood, a very unusual form, but it also ends with blood as well.
That's interesting, Alex, but out of context, and I will have to talk you down if you reveal the context, because there are those who thought this film was much better than, well, I did, and probably I think you do. It's done quite well, but points it makes about capitalism and about the relationship between them and so forth, it had a lot of potential. In my last half hour, I didn't feel that the scenes, the way it was playing out, was convincing me. I found the first part of it extremely interesting, but it didn't develop as convincingly as it ought to have developed. And for that, I blame the script. And the other thing is, do all hedge fund managers have to work in the dark? This movie, from the very, very start, even when you're outside, it's dark because this is a dark theme. Get it? And it is not a subtle movie. It could and should have been much, much better than it is. There are, you know, you get hints of the fateful attraction between the two of them, where is it actually going to lead and why and so forth. No, I have very mixed views about it. I think it's squandered.
Do not watch this movie if you wish to actually be uplifted in any way, shape or form. If you want to feel positive about the human condition, avoid this movie at all costs. 4 out of 10 for me.
I'm sorry, Alex, you've frozen.
4 out of 10. And I freeze on 4 out of 10. I would not go any higher.
No, I, oddly enough, this is a rare sign. I agree. 4 out of 10.
There we are. Fair play. At least Ireland have won, so that's important. Sarah Huntley, it's nice to see you're wearing a kind of emerald green top today to actually celebrate Ireland's moving into the quarterfinals of the Rugby World Cup after a thrashing of Scotland, which is very good.
You sure now?
Yes. Fair Play, is it a movie for yourself on Netflix after you've seen the latest David Beckham documentary?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Oh,
that's all I'm going to give. End of.
Wow.
But Sarah, you might like seeing two humans who become animals in this jungle of competition that is capitalism start turning in on each other.
Yeah, no, I think I'd rather join either Hamas or indeed the other sort of battle that's going on in the Middle East at present. Ooh. But anyway, let's move on to Natasha. Is this one for yourself?
I feel like, from what I'm gathering, from what I've seen of it, and from what Richard has tried to describe, that its heart was in the right place in what it was trying to critique and what it was trying to convey, in that it was trying to call out sort of gender stereotypes and sexism and power struggles within the workplace. So I can see what it was trying to do. It just doesn't seem like it's done it in a particularly particularly good and engaging way. Unfortunately, I don't tend to like movies where the entire plot could be solved where two people communicate, actually properly communicate. So I feel like this movie would frustrate me immensely. But I do have two questions, Richard. Firstly, what was the gender of the director?
Female.
Oh, female, I should have mentioned, I should have given a...
Chloe.
Mention
was her
to...
name. Not Chloe
yeah,
Rose.
Chloe
Dormont is the director, and it's her feature film debut.
That would make sense. I was wondering if a female director had directed it. And secondly, knowing the director of the woman, does it feel like it's a movie that's been directed by a particular gender? Do you
no.
get that kind of sense from the movie?
No, well, no, it's just a bad movie, Natasha.
You don't feel a bias in it?
Firstly, I think that the feminist angle is pushed to a degree where I would certainly, had I not known who directed it, I would have guessed that it was a woman, in the sense that there were so few
Richard,
women.
Richard, what about a transgendered individual? Don't be limiting.
Well, no, I wasn't being limiting. I was being frank. So I would have guessed, but I mean, it could have been.
You may be frank, I could be Francesca. It's all part of the continuum.
I think that it was pretty clear that it was directed by a woman, because certainly given some of the hideous scenes of sexism and that particular story, which is told twice, is but one example. I would have guessed that.
Thanks, Richard. Okay, that makes sense. Awesome. Thank you.
But let's turn to recently returned from the Ukraine, Kathy Manso, thankfully safe and in one piece. Are you still in the Ukraine, Kathy Manso? Is this a movie which you think, yes, let's share this with the world?
I'm still in the Ukraine. So, haha, surprise. and I, you know, that was actually my question to Natasha, so you nailed it. I also wanted to know who wrote it. The gender, that is, who wrote this?
Female.
I will.
Female. Well, and this, you know, not, I might be biased, but I do come from a male-dominated field. And I think female voices are important, of course, but I think a hard time with female voices is that we're, like, as a society, we're not trusted, unfortunately. And I think for a film with the right intentions, it's one of those things where this would have been a really great opportunity for both a man and a woman to work together, to really use both concepts that get misconstrued in communication, you know, especially if there's accusations and when it comes to work and who's doing what and things like that, because those are the things that happen all the time that both men and women struggle with. And especially in a film where, like, it's a male-dominated field, right? So I think if there was a little bit more of a collaboration on that, it could have truly been interesting. But, you know, I only saw the trailer, so you guys actually watched it.
Director and writer, that's Chloe Dorn. So it's her creation. But I think some subtlety would not have gone amiss, especially in that last half hour. That's what cost
well,
it.
Well, Richard, you know, it ends with a potential knifing. We're leaving with all kinds
of... Really, Alex, I really don't... No, you really, really are going way, way, way off path of decency by revealing endings simply to get me to protest.
I'm just trying to do it to prevent people from actually, unfortunately, giving up a couple of hours of their time in terms of watching this. So, say, 4 out of 10, and that's for the nice illuminations.
You should have allowed your mark, 4 out of 10, to speak for itself. If they respected your judgment, they would... You know, they wouldn't watch it. You don't need to give away spoilers. This is a new trait. It's deplorable, and I protest in the name of decency.
Wow. Not a term you can actually apply when you're referring to fair play. But let's talk about artificial intelligence again. Let's talk about a slightly darker version of AI with Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg again. Let's talk about Little Girl again, who's actually the personification of artificial intelligence in a world that's post-nuclear. Richard, the creator.
The creator, yes. And the problem with the creator, it had such a lot of potential because you've got a future where, in point of fact, AI, we had AI with the last Mission Impossible, and this was the villain, so far as there was one, was the so-called process which caused these submarine in the first scene, where I can mention this, to fire missiles itself. I thought Tom Cruise didn't handle the concept very well there, and I think that that's one of the reasons that the film has been considered something of a failure. It certainly failed at the box office. So far as this is concerned, we've had a horrific attack which has devastated, with the loss of a million lives, devastated LA. And what you've had is, in point of fact, the American and the Western nations are determined to believe, or they believe, that AI was responsible for the devastation of LA. And they believe that it is a threat to what is left of humanity, which is, in fact, the West of the world. But AI is in New Asia. It has to be taken down to prevent humanity's extinction, and the US military launches a campaign against it. They're seeking to kill a mysterious architect behind it called Namata. And the USS Nomad is a developed space platform in orbit, which intends to destroy Namata and indeed prevent another catastrophe. And we have, we meet, in fact, early on, the Sergeant Joshua Taylor, played by John David Washington, who incidentally was in that rather, it was a disappointing movie, it was a challenging movie, but called Tenet, which came out at a particularly pivotal
Tenet
time.
Tenet was a perfect movie, Richard. You just didn't give it a chance.
I sometimes have problems when it comes to time travel, and I'm frank about it. He's an agent in New Asia. He's married to Maya, and the United States government believes Maya may be the daughter of Namata. So when American forces attack their home, a pregnant Maya runs away, but she's killed in a subsequent Nomad strike. And yet, is she dead? And the facts are that Taylor is essential to help to track Namata down and destroy AI. And the reason he cooperates subsequently is that he believes that there's a chance that she might be alive. The villains are pretty obvious here. Alison Janney plays one of them and does her stuff. John David Washington has the physicality the role demands. Here is the problem as we approach I can only call it a torturous process, whereby it is revealed, in point of fact, that there's a robotic stimulant in the form of a child who plays an absolutely pivotal role in this movie. the plot, for me anyway, was far too labyrinthine. Where the movie scores, it's rather like Avatar or Avatar 2. You know, there's something about the colors, something about the battle sequences, something about the sets that's amusing or entertaining, or certainly in this case, there's some absolutely awesome reconstructions of various parts of New Asia, most particularly. You've even got that wonderful actor Ken Watanabe. Now, he doesn't have to act here, but he's certainly in one of the tribesmen in New Asia whose existence is being threatened by, obviously, the nomad, which is circling round, ready to destroy what it believes is a threat. It's a curious movie. It's certainly quite long, and for me,
Richard, is it better than Rogue One, which was Gareth Edwards' opus as well?
I didn't see it.
You see, this is the problem when you don't see the Star Wars episodes to actually see Rogue One. Yes, Natasha, you may well be shocked at that. I am calling him out today in an artificial intelligence-induced way. Didn't see Rogue One.
I'm going to say something very controversial here. Rogue One is my favourite Star Wars movie.
Wait a second. I think I did see it.
Oh, backtracking now.
I backtracked. Yes, I think it was a very long time ago. I'd forgotten the title, but I didn't have the opinion. My favourite Star Wars movie was the first one, Natasha, I have to be honest. But I just for a second, I didn't think I'd see them. I have seen all the Star Wars movies, but they do blur somewhat with respect. Alex, I know you're interested in the sci-fi area, and I think you might enjoy the creator, certainly more than me. But as I say, it's a hodgepodge, but it is so infuriatingly complex. I mean, a simple plot would have, or a simpler plot. It's so complicated. But having said that, it's quite a spectacular eyeful if you stay with it the 2.5 hours or thereabouts.
It should have been released in the summer, and it was only made for $80 million. So a budget in comparison to some of the other bloated blockbusters that we've actually had to endure this year. Gareth Edwards, obviously, back to his best. Kathy Manso, are you a Gareth Edwards fan? Would you be checking out The Creator, or is it a case of artificial intelligence? Listen, there's enough of that with Vladimir Putin.
there is a lot of that already. Yeah, I'm kind of curious about it. I'm interested a little bit, especially the, I only saw the trailer, but how they portrayed the AI soldiers is actually based on real soldiers that have been created. Like that technology exists already. I mean, it'll be billions of dollars before that's actually going to be possible, but there are prototypes already. So I'm kind of curious how the reality is kind of playing into this a little bit more. But, you know, my real fear is drones, if I'm going to be honest.
And whereabouts in the Ukraine are you, or can you not say?
I can say I'm in Kharkiv.
Very good. Sarah Huntley, what about yourself and The Creator? Something which you think, yes, I'm frequently thinking about The Creator in all sorts of ways, and this could be the incarnation of it on the silver screen.
I think you've got me there exactly, Alex. If I was thinking of my creator, I'd be thinking of God. I think perhaps I'm a bit of a girly old girl here. I think it's a bit of a boy thing. Sorry.
But it's a little girl who's the artificial intelligence. You can't get more positive than that.
I find it very difficult to engage with science fiction unless it has something deeper to it. I don't think, I'd watch it if I was on a plane possibly and think, oh, this is a challenge, but it wouldn't be the first one Kathy, could I just say, I'm wishing you safe there in Ukraine. So much safety. I admire you so much every time you go. I'm sure we're all wishing you to be very safe.
Thank you. I'll be back soon enough. I leave here sometime between the 17th and the 20th of October.
Meanwhile, Thea van den Bogert is running 4 kilometres around her village. It's the thing she's doing. Anyway, Natasha, are you interested in Pygmalion?
I am interested in listening to hear what Richard thinks of it.
I think he's in love with the whole Eliza Doolittle story. I think he kind of consistently keeps steering back to that. In fact, if you wanted to have a dream scenario, you'd have Pygmalion set in the desert with Lawrence of Arabia tunes in the background. That would probably be the ideal for Richard's sort of number one perfect movie of all time. Anyway, over to you, Richard.
Well, yes, actually, Alex, I'm agreeing with you again. It's almost embarrassing, actually. Yes, yes, my favourite musical and my favourite drama, you've mentioned in My Fair Lady. It is, I think, a problem. Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion was, the name was taken from Ovid, the legend of Pygmalion, the sculptor who creates the ideal woman and then falls in love with her and asks the gods to make her real. This, of course, made into My Fair Lady, which has Bernard Shaw's amazing number of Bernard Shaw's lines and wit, Alan J. Lerner, Frederick Lowe, my favorite musical. And in the days of 1964, the question you asked, because Eliza is a flower seller, Cockney in Covent Garden, Higgins takes her quite literally to Wimpole Street while she arrives there, and he decides...
He does all sorts of mansplaining, and it's all toxic masculinity, Richard.
Have a bet with Colonel Pickering, his good friend who he accidentally runs into, that he could pass her off as a duchess at an embassy ball, or in the case of play, it's very, very interesting the way attitudes have changed. Rex Harrison played Henry Higgins, and these are the days, of course. Higgins is the most appalling misogynist. What he says to Eliza, how he treats Eliza, that aspect of it is completely unacceptable now. But what Harrison had was a diabolical charm to the extent where he inhabited the role and got round these supposedly almost impossible.
He grew accustomed to her face.
Well, we grew accustomed to his face as Henry Higgins, and it's just a diabolical charm that Harrison had. And the main question in those days, and it's going back a long, long time, was how does Eliza transform from a Cockney flower seller into a lady? How is it done?
The rain in Spain falls mainly in the plain.
Indeed. Very good, Alex. Very good. I mean, this was Julie Andrews on stage in the 50s and Audrey Hepburn, somewhat controversially, she didn't sing her songs in the musical. I give the background because it's impossible to see a version of it, and this is at the Old Vic. It's impossible, quite literally impossible for me anyway, to see it without being almost, you could almost say, haunted by the musical. Director Richard Jones does his best, but here you've got, it is quite challenging. You've got, the challenge is not these days, the challenge is not to how Eliza metamorphoses from one to the other, which is a Bernard Shaw send-up of class, of course, but it is whether Henry Higgins, with all his quite literally his lunatic aspect of his character and the way he actually treats someone who's female, can he be believable? And can he be made human enough for us to believe that this
Richard,
isn't...
Two somebody... words. Donald Trump. There's believability for you. End of.
In the case of this particular production, Patsy Ferran is extremely good as Eliza. I mean, she manages the transformation extremely well, and naturally you side with her. But what about Higgins? Because this is a manic character. I mean, I saw at the Old Vic Tim Pigott Smith and Michelle Dockery, who was in Downton Abbey, also as Higgins and Eliza in Pygmalion, must be six, 7 years ago. Sadly, Tim Pigott Smith is now dead. I had to reread the play to realise just how childish Higgins actually was, and that Shaw had written this. Here you've got him as an obsessive, and in that sense, this... He manages to carry off a human aspect of it, whereby he is a first-class linguist. But as a human being, of course, he verges on mania. The funny piece of casting, do you want a Billy Connolly lookalike? John Marquez as Alfred P. Doolittle, the dustman, again, a character who goes into the middle class in the second part of this. And also, again, as I've said, Bernard Shaw's mocking of the English obsession.
Richard, did you like it? Is it a 5 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10?
No. I'd give it a 7 to 8 out of 10 because I think the faults with it were that there were some ridiculous, especially playing Freddy, who Eliza falls for, he's someone without a brain, a terrible casting of some very small roles. That was the reason that I had reservations. But
every actor deserves a chance. That's our line. Even
yes, some of them are absolutely terrible and some of them are extremely good. But no, it's a very enjoyable experience. I thought the principals carry it. The sets, yes, to some extent. The supporting cast, no, on the whole.
Sarah, has that tempted you to go and see this? Or is it a case of, goodness me, how can you actually go and see adequate performances?
No, I would like to go and see it. I think there's a lot of things at issue here because my understanding of Pygmalion, and I've worked on that play quite a lot, is that actually I think Eliza wins because with Higgins, you've got Pickering, and it was my understanding that Pickering is kinder and softer and sees the faults of his friend slightly, going back to the original. And she goes through a process in which she learns who she is, despite class and despite the male-female thing, which seems to be getting into everything in such a big way. It's destroying plot.
I was disappointed Richard had to leave her in and shoehorn some politically correct politics into his review.
I think it's really, really getting on my nerves because aren't people going to go and see a play and realise when that was set, that was what it was like? If you change everything, then what's the point in the story? I think there's equality. I actually think George Bernard Shaw was showing there is that women could stand up to men. And now I really want to go and see it. And I'm not saying anything about the performances, but I fear there's going to be a write-up now about whether this puts women in a weaker light or a stronger light, or whether he's a narcissist or not. I think, to me, the meaning of Pygmalion is that she, through a process which she didn't intend to be put into, let's face it, that was above her control, finds the power to be who she is, regardless of class or being male or female. But I have a horrible suspicion that they probably mucked about with that, or they're manipulating that, and then that isn't the true story. But so much of this is happening with plays that you either do everything new, everything as it is now, or say, sorry, you've really got me on one here, or say we're doing a version of this as if it was set now. And
who knows what the creator intends. Maybe the creator does. To Natasha Wanton, to Kathy Manso, to Richard Fitzwilliams, and to Sarah Huntley, many thanks. Keep watching those movies.